I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to Stories of Scotland, a podcast about Scottish history, folklore, and bogs. I'm Jenny, a naturally acidic environment.
And I'm Annie, some unexpected but exceptionally well-executed knitting, because I tie myself in knots. In this episode, we are once again putting on our wellies and heading out into the bog.
We had an astounding response to our recent episode on bog butter. Honestly, you guys loved that ancient spreadable goodness almost as much as Annie does. I was like, I don't know if this is going to land well, Annie, but nope, people loved it. So, we thought we would bring you all the human equivalent of bog butter, which is bog bodies. Although, it may not be as popular as you can't spread a bog body on toast. I mean, you could try.
And unlike that untasteful joke, this episode is to promote my first ever stage play, which is being performed at Eden Court in Inverness on the 4th of May. It's called The Wound, the Rag and the In-Between, and one of the main plots of this story revolves around a bog body. Tickets are pay what you can, so everyone can come along, and it would be wonderful to see some of you listeners there, so please do get a ticket if you happen to be in the area.
The Wound, the Rag and the In-Between doesn't really give much away, Annie. Is the bog body the In-Between? Because it's stuck in between layers of incredibly slowly decaying organic matter.
Jenny, I am rubbish with titles for naming things. I haven't come up with a good title since I named this podcast, and we started way back in 2019.
Well then, let us use this episode of Stories of Scotland Bogcast to spread your bog far and wide.
Let's start with the basics, Jenny. So what exactly is a bog body and how does it differ from a different dead body that's, say, buried in a graveyard?
Well, before we start on how they differ, let's first look at what our bog body and our bog standard body have in common. First off, they're both dead. And then second off, in the wake of the unfortunate event of their deaths, they're both buried. But this is just about where the similarities end, because the normal body is buried in a traditional grave dug into some regular old soil and earth, whereas our bog body, it is buried, as the name suggests, in a bog. The body buried in a normal earthen grave very quickly becomes dinner for a whole host of organisms. Depending on the specific conditions of the burial site, so temperature, oxygen levels, and pH, various insects, bacteria, and even animals slowly break down and consume the body's soft tissues, ultimately leaving nothing but bones. These go on to decompose much more slowly over the next few hundred years, but in general, it's a fairly swift process.
Although this might seem a little gruesome, under the surface, I think it's wonderful to contemplate how even in death, life can bloom. In some strange way, we live on as the nutrients from our bodies are recycled into the ecosystem and become more life.
Ah, well then, Annie, you'd best hope you aren't buried in a bog. Because the bog body is in a very different environment indeed.
Let me guess, Jenny, it's in a bog.
God, you're good. Yes, it is. And bogs are very wet and very cold. Little life can survive in these conditions, but that which does thrives. These species include mosses, especially sphagnum mosses, shrubs and sedges. And oh, what a wonderfully wet, squelchy life they live. When these plants die, however, the cold and wet environment they once thrived in now prevents their organic matter from fully decaying and breaking down back into components that can be recycled into the ecosystem. This is because the waterlogged land creates anaerobic conditions, which means we have an environment where very little oxygen is present. This, combined with the cold temperatures, means that the normal bacteria and insects and whatnot that would usually break down the organic matter can no longer survive, and thus the organic matter doesn't fully decay. Over hundreds of years, layer upon layer of this partially decayed organic matter slowly form atop each other, each one compressing those that have come before, exacerbating the waterlogged anaerobic conditions and forming peat. To add to this, as the layers of peat grow, those at the bottom begin to slowly rot, and in doing so, they release humic acid or bog acid. This acid diffuses into the surrounding water, making it very acidic, and thus even harder for any bacterial life to survive. And so, these are the conditions into which our bog body has been placed. A far cry from our earthen pal, who is, at this point, happily putrefying in their well-oxygenated, warm and bacteria-filled grave. Because once our body is buried in the bog, the cold, anaerobic, acidic waters engulf it, quickly saturating its soft tissues and effectively preventing bacteria from starting the decomposition process.
Okay, so this sounds like the worst camping trip ever. But what does all of this mean for our bog body?
Well, while not good for decomposition, our bog is great for preservation. And so, some very odd things start to happen to our bog body. You see, the bog acid has a pH of around 2, which is the same as vinegar, which is pretty acidic. So tell me, Annie, when you put something like a cucumber in vinegar, what happens?
It's pickled. Yum, yum, yum.
It is indeed.
I love pickled things.
Well, you're in luck, because in a similar fashion, our bog body is slowly pickled by the acidic waters of the bog. And just like pickling a cucumber makes it last much longer, so too does pickling a body.
Turns out Mother Nature is a trad wife and she's making her own pickles.
I would be so disappointed if Mother Nature was a trad wife. Yes, Mother Nature has her very own pickling pantry. And these naturally occurring conditions all coalesce to create an environment perfect for slowing, altering, and in some cases, completely halting the normal decomposition process. And this brings us onto our first bog body of the episode. But I'm going to go a bit left field and a bit left of Scotland, over to Ireland to begin with, where the old Croghan Man was discovered in a peat bog in 2003 near Croghan Hill. Annie, if I show you this photo of him, can you describe it to the listeners?
Oh my goodness, I would rather not. Well, he's not a whole bog body, but a partial one, as all we've got is an upper torso with arms attached. So there's no head, there's no hips or legs. The skin is a dark reddish brown, folded and wrinkled like a soft leather raisin. The torso is flat, as though no ribcage had ever protected his heart and lungs within. Rather gruesomely, you can see within his chest as well, which is completely cut clean, almost clinically. If I didn't already know how ancient this body was, then I would assume that he'd been sectioned by a chainsaw. But I'm not an expert in dismembering bodies. If it was just this chest section, I don't think I'd actually recognise it for what it is. But we have the arms attached, but they're so clearly defined as arms and hands. There's a bend in his elbows, clear veins in his forearms, and his fingers are curled. It's very human, and yet it's so uncanny. It reminds me of a piece of artwork. It doesn't quite look real. And he's also wearing a band of some sort around his left bicep.
That was a wonderful description, Annie. Thank you. I'll pop pictures up on our Instagram. So you can either Google the old Krogan man or head over to our Instagram and you can see some pictures up there.
Or don't. Just don't.
But the dark reddish brown coloration of the skin that you describe, Annie, is seen pretty uniformly across all bog bodies. It's caused by the same thing that gives peaty water that distinctive golden brown colour, tannins. Because sphagnum mosses, the most abundant type of mosses in bogs, naturally excrete tannins. These tannins bind to the collagen proteins in the skin of these bodies and act as a protective coat, resulting in the skin becoming more flexible, water-resistant, and bacteria-resistant, as well as dyeing it this reddish-brown colour. Essentially, the tannins soak into the bog body and further protect the organic matter from decay, resulting in this phenomenally well-preserved, dark, leathery skin that we can see so clearly on the old Krogan man.
So, it not only looks leathery, but it's actually quite similar to leather because leather is made from the tanning of animal hides.
Yeah, exactly. But while the acidic waters tan the skin, fingernails and hair, the acid actually also slowly dissolves the bones by leaching out the calcium, hence why he looks like a leathery deflated balloon.
And I imagine his skin is also very hard because to keep leather soft in the tanning process, it needs to be constantly moved. But because he's still for such a long time in the bog, I think as soon as you bring him out, he'll dry out completely.
Yeah, one of the major problems with removing bog bodies from the bogs is it's incredibly hard to replicate those conditions. So often when you take them out the bog, they completely deteriorate and essentially dry up into little husks and look nothing like they did as they were being preserved in the bogs.
At first glance of this piece of body, I actually thought it was a handbag because it looks so much like processed leather. And it's only when I saw his hands that I realised what I was looking at. And it's given me nightmares since, I'm not going to lie.
Well, I think it's fascinating. I could look at bog bodies all day. I don't know, I'm intrigued by them. But the Krogan man is so well preserved that a lot of information can be discerned from the body parts that have been found. This man lived and died over 2,000 years ago, sometime between 362 to 175 BCE, so at the height of the Iron Age. At the time of his death, he was in his mid-20s and exceptionally tall for the time period, clocking in at well over 6 feet. The contents of his stomach were so well preserved by the bog that we know that his last meal was oats and buttermilk, but that his general diet was mainly meat-based, which would have been an expensive luxury. His nails were both well-preserved and well-manicured, leading the researchers to deduce that this fellow did not live a life of hard labour. And interestingly, and just bear with me because this is going to get a little bit weird for a second, but both of his nipples had been removed prior to him being put in the bog. Researchers think that this may have been a deliberate act, as at the time he was living in ancient Ireland, the king's nipples symbolised the life-giving sun, and so to suck on a king's nipples was a sign of submission. And so, if a man had his nipples deliberately cut off or injured, this meant that he could never be king, as other men could never submit to him properly.
I am sorry, what did you just say?
Please don't make me say it again, Annie. I told you it was going to get weird. But all of this has led researchers to theorise that this fellow likely enjoyed a position of power when he was alive. In death, he was brutally killed and buried at the foot of a hill used for kingship rituals. And so, he may have been a failed king, possibly ceremoniously killed for his lack of leadership during times of famine or war, or maybe a failed candidate for king who was ritually killed, decapitated, and buried in the bog at the foot of the hill he would never summit.
It's frustrating that we know so much because of the preservation, but to me, it just leads to more questions. And we really can't be certain about things, for example, the symbolism of a removed nipple, but we can look at the patterns and make a guess. Though I'm still not sure how these researchers do it.
Denial. But however this man ended up in the bog, his remains are a natural leathery time capsule. The oats in his stomach were planted, tended, and harvested by his people. The buttermilk was freshly churned, sweet and light. The band on his bicep was once tight around it. His body once whole and full of life, walking the bogs that have held him so long in death. But not all bog bodies are equal, and the reason I started with the old Croghan man is that, despite his lack of nipples, he does actually have a lot of soft tissue remaining.
Okay, this is interesting because not many of the Scottish bog bodies have that much soft tissue left at all.
Yes, and there are a few reasons for this. One is that different bog conditions will do different things to bodies. For example, if the body is interred in the bog swiftly after death and during the colder months, then the preservation will be more complete as the conditions for bacteria to gain a foothold are fully thwarted, and thus very little decomposition can take place at all. In addition to this, different types of bogs can affect the preservation process differently. Raised bogs with very little drainage and a lot of rainwater best preserve soft tissues, whereas fens and transitional bogs preserve the skeletons much more successfully. But while these bodies are preserved, decomposition isn't totally halted, just slowed down massively. And bog conditions are constantly changing, both from natural causes and man-made ones. Changes in temperature, rainfall, plant species, and land use can all alter the rate at which decomposition occurs. So a bog body that has been pickled for 2,000 years can quickly be broken down if the bog is drained and planted with trees, for instance.
It's a bit like how if you shift slightly the condition of your pickles, you can get them to ferment. Sauerkraut, kimchi, anyone?
See, that gives me the heebie-jeebies more than bog bodies.
And moving forward, there's a fascinating pair of bog bodies that were found at Claghallen in South Uist that fit this disrupted decomposition that you're speaking of.
Ah, yes, I know the very ones. Because in this case, we're dealing with mummies.
Okay, pull this back. When I hear mummies, I have a lot of inbuilt assumptions, and I think most of them are wrong. So I'm thinking of ancient Egyptian tombs, pyramids, lots of bandages.
And films with Brandon Fraser in his well-oiled prime.
No, Jenny, he has just met his acting prime now and got his Oscar for it, and he deserved it. So back to the kind of common cultural imagination on mummies. Because it's true, the ancient Egyptians were massive fans of mummification. They used it for human bodies as part of their funeral practices, and they also used it for animal bodies as part of their spiritual practices, especially with cats. The Egyptian mummification process was highly ceremonial, practiced and perfected over 2,000 years. First, they would remove all their internal organs except for the heart, and then a salt called natron was used to suck up and remove all the moisture from the body. The body would then be wrapped in many layers of linen strips coated with resin. This process took approximately 70 days, and then the body was finally ready for the afterlife. However, although these are by far the most well-known mummies, the ancient Egyptian way of creating a mummy is not the only method. Cultures all across the globe developed their own practices for mummification.
Aw, everyone has mummy issues.
Not just Freud.
Yeah, mummies are simply bodies where the soft tissues are preserved long after death by either chemicals or environmental factors such as bogs. Interestingly, did you know that they think the first Egyptian mummies were probably accidents, as the incredibly dry air and sands of the Egyptian desert preserve some bodies that were buried in shallow sand pits? So, kind of the extreme opposite of bog body mummification, but mummification nonetheless.
So, before researching this episode, I'd assumed the word mummy came from a shortened version of mummified body. However, I was wrong, because of course mummy as a noun comes way before mummification. We start with the Persian word mum, meaning wax, and then the medieval Arabic word mumya, meaning embalmed corpse. Apologies for my pronunciations. And now that I know that mummy comes from wax, I will never look at Madame Tussauds in the same way again.
I would absolutely love a Madame Tussauds where it's just, they're all bog bodies.
Okay, so what makes the Caracalline mummies rather than just your standard old bog body?
Well, Annie, here's the plot twist. These Clag Hallan bodies weren't actually found in a bog.
Okay, I feel like you're violating the bog cast rules today. First, you give me a bog body from Ireland, and now a bog body not even found in a bog. The first rule of bog cast is that the bodies need to be in the bogs. Did you even read the outline, Jenny?
Nope. But stick with me, because this is cool and definitely worth breaking the bogcast rules for. So, in 2001, a team of archaeologists were conducting a dig in Clag Hallan in the Outer Hebrides. They were excavating the remains of four roundhouses, dwellings commonly used in the Bronze Age. However, uncommonly, buried beneath the floor in one of these roundhouses, they uncovered the skeletons of two people, a man and a woman, each curled tightly into the fetal position. Now, while this itself was odd, it would soon get odder still. Because when they conducted tests on each skeleton, they found that it was not as simple as a man and a woman buried together. Rather, the male skeleton was actually composed of the body of one man, the skull of a second, and the jawbone of a third. And the female was a composite skeleton too, with the body of a woman, the head of a man, and the right arm of a third person. Weirder still, two teeth had been removed from the skull and were found in the skeleton's hand. The female skeleton was dated from about 1300 BCE, and the various parts of it came from about a 150-year span, whereas the male was older, being dated from around 1600 BCE, so over 3,500 years old, and his extra parts came from a 300-year span.
Okay, so while I am going to agree that this is a little bit strange, I don't see what these composite skeletons have to do with bog bodies. Couldn't they just be an eccentric Bronze Age burial oddity? Let's pop all these different parts in a tomb together and see what they do.
Well, at this point, that is what the archaeologists are thinking too. But things aren't quite adding up. And if there's one thing archaeologists love, it's maths.
Actually, I think it's bones and Gore-Tex.
Some of them like maths too. Because they didn't only radiocarbon date the skeletons, but also the pits that the skeletons were buried in. And while the bodies came out to be between 3,000 and 3,500 years old, the pits had been dug hundreds of years after this, meaning that the bodies were buried a long time after they had died.
Okay.
But remember, Annie, these bodies were found in tightly curled fetal positions. It would be impossible for someone to take a long dead skeleton and arrange it in this perfect way. So the archaeologists realised that the skeletons must have been articulated when placed in the pit, meaning that upon the time of burial, hundreds of years after they had died, the bones were still being held together with skin and sinew. They had been mummified.
Okay, now we're talking.
Yeah, but this was still a wild theory, and the archaeologists needed more evidence to back it up. So they kept digging, both physically and metaphorically. The bones, once dated, were scrutinised under the microscope, and the archaeologists saw that they showed very low levels of bacterial bioerosion.
First archaeology, then maths, now biology. What else are these wild archaeologists going to be dating next?
They're a talented lot. But as a body putrefies in the early stages of decomposition, the bacteria that are consuming it leave traces all over the areas they are unable to consume, i.e. the bones. And these microscopic traces are called bacterial bioerosion marks. The more bioerosion marks present on bones, the more likely a normal decomposition process occurred. Thus, the lack of significant bacterial bioerosion on these skeletons suggested that initial putrefaction was halted in some way.
Halted? Now I see where this is going.
That's right, Annie. Back in the bog. Because here come the chemists to show that the bones also showed signs of demineralization, a process that occurs in acidic conditions.
They're bog bodies.
They're bog bodies. Through all this painstaking research conducted over decades, the archaeologists have worked out that the bodies were buried shortly after death in a peat bog and then left there for somewhere between 6 to 18 months, long enough for decomposition to be stopped and the skin to be tanned, but not long enough to completely demineralise the bones. The bodies were then removed, wrapped in cloth, and placed in a warm, dry, possibly sacred place for hundreds of years, before finally being buried beneath the roundhouse floor.
So the people of Bronze Age Scythiast deliberately put these bodies in a bog, knowing that that condition would mummify them, and then dug them up and kept them for hundreds of years in a hut on the beach?
Yeah, pretty much. Imagine that stop in the North Coast 500.
Scythiast isn't in the North Coast 500. But I'll get out my island pass and give it a review anyway, Jenny. The Bronze Age has absolutely no facilities for our caravan. When we stopped and asked for directions, the locals sat there like literal corpses holding their teeth in the palms of their hands. When we asked to speak to the manager, we were confronted by a feral goat. We requested a refund and money was paid in the form of rancid butter. 0 out of 10 would not recommend.
Are you kidding me? If I was confronted by a feral goat, anywhere, 10 out of 10 experience.
Gotta love them feral goats.
This discovery was the first ever evidence of deliberately mummified bodies in Britain. But not the last. Using this bioerosion trick, many other Bronze Age skeletons from all over Britain were tested, and 16 of the 34 human remains show similarly halted bacterial bioerosion, suggesting that this was in fact a widespread practice for Bronze Age communities. They would actively choose to mummify some of their dead. Even communities not near bogs practice this, and it's thought that they may have mummified their bodies through drying and smoking them. However, although widespread, archaeologists don't actually think it was too common, because the vast majority of Bronze Age folk were cremated upon death, so very few skeletal remains are found, and those that are most likely people of high status.
So similarly to the Krogan man, these people were probably leaders, or at least very important people within their communities.
Yeah, but I think it's safe to say they were probably more revered than the Krogan man, for they were not decapitated and put in a bog. They were deliberately preserved so they could remain for centuries after their deaths, as a tangible link to the lives they lived and the memories of those preserving them. The researchers currently theorise that these bodies were kept in the roundhouse they were found in to create some sort of sacred, religious, ceremonial, spiritual, symbolic place, possibly a shrine for the surrounding community to connect with the supernatural realm of the spirits and the dead.
Okay, so it's two bodies, but multiple people, because what about the fact that there were different skulls, arms and jaws? What do they think that this meant?
Well, it's an interesting one because they consider it to possibly symbolise the importance of shared ancestry and to imbue younger generations with the same reverence of those who came before. You know, if there's a part of your grandfather and your great-grandmother and, you know, all in the same body, then it's sort of like a symbol of the generation spiralling through time. But my theory is that it was just plain old straight-up wear and tear. You know, on one particularly windy day, the jaw was blown loose off the head and stolen by an unruly dog. And so they were like, you know what? We're just going to have to mummify another one and patch up great-great-great-great-grandpa.
I wonder if the body parts themselves have a particular significance. For example, if someone's a particularly good singer, you might be like, well, let's give this singer's jaw to great-great-great-great-grandfather, and then great-great-great-great-grandfather will be the best singer in the afterlife. Let's give this strong sword arm to granny.
Yeah, and if someone was really, really smart, then you save their noggin and stick it on a body. I like that theory, yeah.
Let us know your theories of why we'd stick bits of human bodies together, other than your horror stories. Thank you.
Maybe there was just like a psychopath living in a bog.
I know, it's a bit Silence of the Lambs, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Silence of the Goats.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, to hunt for our next body, we're heading to Shetland on the 12th of May 1951, where we have two jolly men, both named James. They are digging in a standard Shetland peat bog, or whatever could befall them, and there's a lovely stream just a few metres away.
Now, our two Jameses are digging for peats to be used for fuel.
This is one of the reasons why there are so many more bog bodies in Ireland than in Scotland, even though both countries have their fair share of bogs. In Scotland in the 19th and 20th centuries, there was much easier access to coal as a source of fuel, and so there were fewer people digging peats because coal was more accessible and it burnt better. However, there are still, to this day, islands and rural parts of Scotland that use peat as a local form of fuel. Especially within traditional crofts, you do have the right to dig peats, which means that you pay for the fuel with your hard labour instead of your coin. Whereas in Ireland, coal was far less common, and so peat was used much, much more. And the more you dig in the peat bogs, the more you find bog treasures, from butter to bodies.
Our pair of Jameses get approximately 30 inches deep, and then they find something incredibly unexpected. Remains. So they keep excavating, and they uncover a shallow grave, the head pointing east-southeast. They've just discovered the Gunnister Man. This is an exceptional body, both because of what it is and what it isn't. From the clothes, this body presents as a man. All of his clothing is woolen and dyed brown by the peat. On his head, there's this gorgeous wee knitted cap.
Oh, it's a lovely little hat with a patterned turned up brim. And it would perch on your head in a way where it doesn't cover your ears. So this guy was ye olde hipster. And it seems that he was a big hat fan, because another small cap was found on his body, in a position that suggested it was inside his pockets.
Aha! The famous Agatha Christie book, The Mystery of the Disappearing Pockets of the Bog Body. We'll get to that in a moment.
I would say that was more one of our lesser known ones, Annie.
He's not as old as the bog bodies we've previously mentioned, but the complete clothing of the Gunnister Man is so exceptionally well preserved and such a valuable artifact, because it's unbelievably rare for the clothes of non-aristocratic people to last for more than 100 years, let alone a whole outfit. Here we can see exactly what a regular person was wearing around the year 1700.
Well, a regular hipster was wearing.
For any people who play video games out there, he's dressed like a hard-working peasant in any European historic RPG. And I suspect a lot of game designers have looked at his clothing for inspiration. He wears stockings, which are reinforced with extra fabric at the foot so that they can be worn for longer and don't form holes in the regular places, like your socks, Jenny. His shoes are called rivlins, which are made from cured and dried animal skin. So, a rivlin is a shoe made of untanned animal skin. So we have the hair of the animal on the outside of the shoe, and it's essentially a chunk of skin that's gathered round the foot and tied through a thin rope that's threaded in the opening. It's a cool kind of shoe. We'll pop up some photos on our socials. The Gunnister Man also wore a woolen jacket with matching breeches and gloves. His jacket was layered on top of a long coat, and because of all this warm clothing, it's assumed that he met his death in winter, or at very least in cold weather.
There were artifacts found in the position of pockets, but not inside them. So it's assumed that the breeches did have pockets, however, that they were made out of another substance, such as linen, which responded differently to the bog conditions and decayed away rather than be preserved. However, the pockets aren't the only thing mysteriously digested by the hungry bog, because the vast majority of the body was also consumed. And though only human remains were a few fragments of bone found in his stockings and the sleeves of his clothes, a little chunk of skull and some brown curly hair that had no trace of grey.
This is what I find so intriguing about this case. His body is almost completely gone, but all of his woolen clothing remains. And the curator within me is very interested in what happens to human remains once they've been discovered and how they become managed by heritage organisations, because it's always a bit of an ethical quandary. And I think this is a case where we've got Ollie's woolen artefacts of his clothing and accompanied by only a very small part of his body. In the modern day, we consider it very bad etiquette to dig up a graveyard to see what people of the past were wearing. However, if we happen to stumble upon a body, does it suddenly become free game for display? How many decades or perhaps centuries need to happen between a death and the discovery of a corpse for it to be okay for us to treat a body as though it can be studied like any other artifact?
I don't know, Annie. I think my gut tells me somewhere about like 70. Like, I suppose, is it like, how long would it take for everyone you know and love to die? So maybe more than 70. Get me at the ground at 70. I'll be fine with that.
For me, it comes down to the culture that buried the people originally and the beliefs surrounding the dead.
However, with the Gunnistan man, we only have tiny pieces of his human remains. So he's built by his clothes, not his bones. So let's loop this round. There were two newspapers that I came across when looking for more information about the Gunnistan man's body. And first, I found a curious article from Dundee in 1951 when the grave was discovered.
Crofters find a giant's grave. Two crofters digging on mainland, the largest of the Shetland Isles, unearthed what appears to have been a uniform for a nearly 7-foot-tall man.
You didn't mention he played for the NBA, Annie.
Well, I think it may have been misinterpreted that the length of his coat and his high stockings were indicating a very tall person. But I think he was just a man who wanted his clothes to completely envelop himself.
I get it. He's a baggy-clothed hipster. You're literally describing how I dress right now. I got those little hats that don't cover my ears. All my clothes are men's clothes that are way too big for me.
So I looked at the measurements of his garments and, for example, his sleeve would be the same size that I would wear and I'm only 5'4". So I'm going to assume that he's not a giant.
Boring.
And the second article takes us back to my question about what happened to his human remains. It's about archaeologist Audrey Henschel, who was examining his stockings in the millennium.
His socks had been crudely patched, and when Miss Henschel put her hand into the bottom of it, she pulled out his toenails, which had survived in the peat.
Ah, no one wants to find any toenails in socks, let alone corpse toenails.
Here's my burning question, Jenny. What does a modern museum do when they uncover toenails in a bog sock?
Put them straight in the bin.
No, Jenny. You can't just bin someone's human remains.
It's yes, you can.
A good thing you are not an archaeologist or a curator.
Yeah, I'm not good enough at maths.
But I needed to know, Jenny, so I wrote to the National Museum of Scotland and I asked them what happened to both the Gunnistan man's skull and bone fragments that were described when his body was originally found and then his toenails.
You know, sometimes, Annie, you really shouldn't let those intrusive thoughts win.
Well, they did, Jenny, and the museum actually responded. So the National Museum doesn't think that they ever received a skull fragment for the Gunnistan man. So I'm guessing that the peat diggers probably reburied it, because they did later add a rough gravestone to mark the site where the Gunnistan man was found. However, the museum do still have some small bone pieces and a single toenail that is kept alongside the textiles.
I'm sorry. I can deal with putrefaction and pickling, but there's something about toenails that I just can't deal with. Oh, I guess the bigger question is, why can you deal with that? Why are you focusing so much on the toenails?
I'm really curious. I wanted to know, because again, I feel like I'm breaking Bogcast rules in that he's technically a bog body, but there's only tiny fragments of his actual body. But his toenail was one of them, and I couldn't figure out what had happened to it. Was it back in the bog? And I like to imagine someone walking around the afterlife completely naked because all of their clothes are still in the bog and missing a few toenails and a little piece of their skull. Anyway, beyond his pedicure, the Gunnister man had some brilliant artifacts. The coins he carried come from between the 1680s and the 1690s, so they pin him to quite a specific point in time. They were from both Sweden and the Netherlands, so it's likely that he was a traveller. However, his coin purse is knitted in quite a traditional Shetland pattern. Now, he also carried a horn container with a wooden plug, which was possibly for holding ink, which would go with his quill and writing board. He also had a horn spoon and a silk ribbon. There have been many guesses as to how the Gunnister man and his silk ribbon ended up buried in the peat bog. There's local folklore that he was either a sheep thief who had drowned in a bog pool one cold winter evening, or instead, he was a great laird who had lost his way on his own lands. I love it when folklore gives us the full spectrum of wealth for this character. However, I prefer the legend that he's John Oliphant, a staunch Jacobite supporter who gave a toast for Bonnie Prince Charlie to return to Scotland. He then stepped out into the dark night and disappeared, never to be heard from again. However, overall, the Gunnister man is most commonly labelled as neither thief, laird, nor Jacobite. Usually he's just described as a traveller who met his death in a peat bog in winter. Because so little of his body remains, there are many questions about how he died. He could have been murdered. However, the possession of his knitted purse with coins in it suggests that whatever motives were not theft. And there's not marks in his clothes that suggest he was violently attacked. It's more likely that he died on his journey and his body was discovered in the bog and people buried him where he fell. The final thing about the Gunnister man is that a wooden pail was found with his body. It's assumed that he would have used this pail to carry his food. But Jenny, what do you think this bucket looks like?
Annie, that looks like a lovely bucket that could have been happily filled with plentiful amounts of butter.
It does, doesn't it? Now, there was no butter in his bucket, but there could have been 300 years ago, and he just happened to eat it before dying in the bog.
A bogcaster can dream.
Yes, we can, Jenny. Yes, we can. Well, Jenny, my new stage play takes a grain of inspiration from the tragic story of a woman named Betty Corrigal. And while my play is completely fictional, Betty Corrigal was a very real person. But I do just want to preface this with the limitations that I've come up against when researching her life. I much prefer to be able to use original archive materials. However, I've only been able to find secondary sources for Betty. And unfortunately, none of them reference primary materials for me to go and look at. So I contacted Orkney Archives themselves, and they pointed me towards the secondary sources as well. So we've got published books and we've actually used the visitor information sign at her gravesite. So I just want to acknowledge those gaps when we're telling her story.
Consider them acknowledged. Our story begins either in the 1770s or the early 1800s. And although we don't know the exact year, we do know that Betty Corrigal is around 27. There's a little uncertainty about when she was born, but she was a young woman when she died. She lived in the southeast of the rugged island of Hoy, a large island off the south coast of the main island of Orkney. She lived in a wee cottage called Greengayer's Cottage, close to Mills Bay, part of the sheltered waters of Scapa Flow.
We're going to assume that Betty Corrigal had a similar life to other women in rural Scotland during the late 18th, early 19th century. She would have worked very hard, likely both within the cottage and either on the land or in some kind of role supporting the fishing industry. She would have likely had skills in sewing or knitting, perhaps supplementing the family income by selling small knitted items.
At the age of 27, Betty was still unmarried. However, she found herself falling for a fisherman, who is never named in any of the sources. Betty soon falls pregnant by the fisherman. However, instead of taking responsibility for the child, he jumps on the next boat and finds himself in a different, distant harbour.
So this leaves Betty in a dreadful situation, solely because of the stigma that society pushes on to unmarried, pregnant women in this time period. Although I'm just going to highlight, it was much less unusual for women to have children out of wedlock during this time period than everyone imagines. It was quite common for couples in rural communities to live together as though they were man and wife, and to call each other husband and wife, and for no one else to question this and just to assume that they'd got married in a different parish. So it was really a matter of perception.
However, because Betty was unmarried and alone, she was outrightly rejected and outcast by her community. Her circumstances could have been completely transformed if the man who got her pregnant had stayed and supported her, but he was never to return to Mills Bay again. Betty fell into despair and very sadly came to the conclusion that she couldn't continue carrying the weight of the condemnation for her community. So she turned to the same sea who had bought her the man who had abandoned her. And in her desperation, she walked into the waters with the intention of never returning. However, some locals saw what was happening and rescued her, bringing her back to shore. Within a few days, Betty was found hanged, and it's assumed that she took her own life. Unlike the rest of the UK, suicide wasn't criminalised in Scotland at this time. However, it was treated as a gravely mortal sin. It wouldn't have been impossible for sympathy to be taken on Betty's case. However, the deeply religious community shunned her, even in her death. And because it was assumed that she took her own life, her body was rejected for burial within consecrated ground. So they wouldn't let her be buried in a graveyard.
So it is likely that she took her own life. But because there's no records actually telling us this, we are just going by the hearsay on it. So I think that's why we're being quite careful with this wording. And I think we need to look at the leaders of this community to see who's really prejudiced against Betty and who feel so threatened by an unmarried pregnant woman.
Because it was the Lairds of Melster who refused Betty a grave on their lands.
And so it came to be that Betty was buried in an unmarked grave in a peat bog, right on the boundary line between the parishes of North Walls and Hoy. She was buried on the boundary line because both parishes had refused to have her.
I've looked at maps of the old parish boundaries, and her gravesite does fall onto this marker line. And it was possibly her family members who buried her in this place. And this is how the tragic tale of Betty Corrigal would have finished, and likely have been long forgotten, had it not been for two men cutting peats.
Yes, because in the spring of 1933, the family of George Robb were cutting peats and came across the corner of a wooden box. And many people had long forgotten that Betty had been buried in the bog. And so when the peat spades struck the box, the diggers assumed it could have been some kind of treasure, perhaps from an old Viking raid. And so they contacted the postmaster, Isaac Moore. And they came to the decision to crack open the box. However, they did not find gold or silver or any precious gems. It's reported in the newspaper of May 1933 as a gruesome find in Hoy, because upon opening her coffin, they discovered the corpse of a woman intact, with flesh as when she died. One source suggests that her long, dark hair lay in curls around her shoulders, and another tells us that her hair was in the early stages of turning grey and her skin had an ashen hue. There's folklore that the noose used to hang Betty was put in the coffin with her. However, this noose quickly turned to dust when exposed to air. However, I don't think that's how peat bogs work.
But because the body was in such good condition, the police were unsure of when it had been buried, so they began investigating the case, and pretty quickly pieced together the local knowledge of Betty's story. Once foul play had been ruled out, it was decided that she should be laid back to rest in the same spot. However, even still, her death was not peaceful. During the Second World War, Scapa Flow was Britain's chief naval base. Soldiers were set up in camps all over Orkney, including on Hoy, and either from hearing old tales or digging for peats themselves, they rediscovered Betty's body. And they were fascinated with how well preserved she was, as though she was a kind of snow white figure. And so the soldiers began to dig her up again and again out of curiosity and to look upon her face. And they even nicknamed her the Lady of Hoy. Eventually, her grave was moved by 50 yards and a slab of concrete was put over the top of it to deter the disrespectful and, frankly, unacceptable behaviour.
However, the first person to give a name to the Lady of Hoy was also a soldier, and he was named Jerry Mayer. He didn't want Betty to be forgotten, so he searched for her history and published his findings. Now, Jerry was stationed in Orkney during World War II and co-edited the wartime newspaper The Orkney Blast, which was written to boost morale of the soldiers of the big Navy base.
Great name. The Orkney Blast. Love it.
So Jerry spoke to an old woman who had remembered Betty's story and he published it. And that was the first written mention I could find of her name, was in The Orkney Blast. So although it was despicable that the soldiers were digging her up, I think Jerry brings back honour through giving her back her name. Now, at the end of the Second World War, an American minister came across to Orkney and heard the story of the grave. So he decided to put a little wooden cross over Betty's grave and a picket fence, so that people would be deterred from ever digging it up again. And then Betty could finally rest in peace. There was a small, solemn ceremony. And then in 1976, a fiberglass headstone was erected because it was thought that a stone one would be too heavy and it would sink down into the peat. This headstone reads very simply, "Here lies Betty Corrigal." His story has inspired a lot of folk song, poetry and art. I think a lot of people connect to the tale of Betty. I think it really moves people that she faced so much prejudice and that her life ended in such tragedy. And what we have of her story was only really stitched together after her body was found and from generational memory. Now, I've looked at church records of births and deaths. I wasn't able to pinpoint which Corrigal Betty could have been. However, I feel like with more research at the Fiscal Archives, we could maybe find more information. So next time I'm in Orkney, I'm definitely going to look for that. And if anyone out there is looking to research it, get digging in the archives and not in the bog.
I feel like all the bog bodies we've covered today seem to have a thread of sadness connecting them. From our Croghan man to our lost or even murdered Gunniston man to poor Betty Corrigal, all these folk ended up buried in bogs in some grim, violent or plain sad way. Although I do suppose the two Bronze Age mummies could be an exception to this, as they seem to be preserved out of reverence. But still, even in death, they weren't allowed to rest. They were made to work for another few hundred years. Who wants that? I mean, what is this? Neo-capitalism of the afterlife?
Ah, Jenny. One thing that's true is taxes, not death. You don't get to die when you're a bog body.
I don't know. I suppose at some level, they could do it to us, Annie. They could mummify us and then put us in front of two microphones. And then in 3,000 years, they could find us and look at our lovely, soft writer's hands and be like, oh, these folk knew no manual labour. They must have been queens.
Though we may have perfectly preserved parts of either the people or their clothes, there's still giant gaps in their stories. These cases give us some pristine details to examine, but not quite a full picture. Bogs are liminal in-between spaces. They aren't neatly marked for us like graveyards when we can have a name, date, occupation and family members carved into a rock. Sometimes we only get left with these very fine brushstrokes to look at, such as a beautifully knitted purse with international coins. And from this, we have to guess at which of 1,500 narratives could be correct.
I think there's also a fascination with mortality and the way that bogs stop the normal signs of decay. From ancient people using a bog to mummify remains before excavating them again, to soldiers wanting to gawp at Betty Corrigal, people are drawn to look at bog bodies, and I have to say, I'm in that group. Although I do hate the thought of digging up bodies for them specifically just to be gazed at, I do think it shows people wanting to confront and understand death and challenge the ideas that we have around death, because when you see something different and exceptional like a bog body, it totally reframes how you think about death and the afterlife and spirituality and raisins.
So there are a lot of efforts to preserve peatlands in Scotland, and because of this we are going to have a lot of bog bodies that will never be discovered, and with them they'll keep so many memories in their strange raisin-like skin.
Yeah, and these mysteries do kind of drive me crazy, because people may have been placed in bogs in ancient times because they were considered sacred places that would somehow protect a corpse from decomposition. Or in modern times, bogs were places where you could hide bodies or put bodies that couldn't make it to the graveyard, either because of their status as a victim or a culprit. They just seem like places where the regular rules of life and death don't seem to apply.
It's just like bog butter, isn't it? Right now, so many sublime bog butters are just sleeping peacefully in their beautiful peat bog. And with them is probably the answer to the meaning of life itself. And on that note, dearest bog dwellers, thank you so much for listening. We are generously supported by our kind Patreon subscribers. So if you're enjoying Stories of Scotland and would like to help us keep making this show, then you can head over to patreon.com/storiesofscotland. Now, Patreon have been offering a free membership option. However, it's just a way for them to harvest your data and it doesn't benefit us at all. If you'd like to support us financially, then please don't use this free option. We really value the support of Patreon subscribers, and it means that we can take a small part-time salary each for making the show. It doesn't cover all of our time, but we do get a little compensation for the work that we're spending researching, writing, editing, and publishing this show, which is more work than we ever could have imagined, but we absolutely love doing this and we adore how engaged you are as a community and how you are willing to come with us on some very surreal journeys. So thank you all so much for the ongoing support.
Yes, thank you to all our supporters out there, and welcome to our newest Patreon members: Jessica, Stephanie, Fraser, Caroline, Jonathan, Robin, Scott, Brent, Alyssa, and a big shout out to Ben and Melinda. Thank you guys so much.
I love Ben trying to do a romantic gesture to give her
a patron for her birthday present, and we're like, so Melinda, I'm really sorry, but you're in the bog body episode now. His love is as big as 100 pounds of bog butter that's been buried for 3,000 years.
And long may it be preserved.
Finally, my play is on May the 4th at Eden Court in Inverness. If you happen to be here, please do come along. Jenny, have you got your tickets yet?
Yes.
It's pay what you can tickets. So I'll pop a link in the episode so that both any listeners who happen to be in Inverness and Jenny can grab them now. Until next time, thank you so much, everyone. Slanjava.
Slanjava.
Of course, it's considered very bad etiquette to dig up a graveyard.
Etiquette rather than etiquette.
Say it again.
Etiquette. Like it has a K
etiquette.
In it. Yeah.
Etiquette.
Which means that you pay for the fuel with your hard labour instead of your coin.
Coin. Coin.
I swear you put this word in just...
I don't, because I've heard you say coin when you're not reading it and you say it like a
coin.
Normal person. But as soon
coin.
As...
I don't think I do. Coin. Coin. Okay. Ooh, why the silk ribbon?
Because a ribbon brings you a sixpence worth of happiness, Jenny. Though the economy was different in his time, so...
Is that a saying or did you just make that up? A sixpence worth of happiness.
It goes back to archive school when I researched a shop in Aberystwyth that sold mostly hats, but also a lot of ribbons. And I asked why so many ribbons were being sold, and my archive teacher said, a ribbon is a sixpence worth of happiness. And that has stuck with me for a decade.
All right. I'm not sure if you're making that up or not.
No.
All right, well, now our listeners know the worth of a ribbon.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.